Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Cities are booming, massive urban centers like San Francisco, Seattle, even San Antonio, Texas, fueled by big tech. Huge salaries and huge opportunities, that's created overwhelming demand for housing. And supply, it simply can't keep up. Take Seattle, for instance. Microsoft and Amazon's backyard has added roughly 100,000 jobs, but barely 32,000 new homes and apartments since the end of the financial crisis. And city zoning laws make it nearly impossible to build anything other than a single-family home. So what's the answer? Should housing be higher density? Should there be radical policy change? This hour on Point, the crisis of affordability in the nation's hottest housing markets. You can join us on air or online. Are sky-high housing costs keeping you from moving to a major city? If you're already there, do you worry you'll be priced out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Seattle, Washington is Paul Roberts. He's a journalist who covers economics, business, and overall social disruption. You can find a link to his big Politico piece that's headlined, "My Generation Is Never Gonna Have That," at our website. That's onpointradio.org. Paul Roberts, thank you for joining us.
Hey, David.
So your piece, "My Generation Is Never Going to Have That," it opens with a vignette and the tale of a 27-year-old programmer named Zach Lubarsky, if I'm pronouncing it right.
That's right.
Zach. So Paul Roberts, tell me a little bit why you focused on him and what you learned from him about how things were going in your adoptive city of Seattle.
Well, he's sort of the face of a generation that is really into cities like Seattle, really attracted to them both for job prospects and also the culture, and yet is finding it ever more challenging to find a place to live in those cities. So he also represented sort of the activist side of the millennial generation, particularly a segment that
had been, activist on this very issue.
Right, that had been sort of radicalized by the housing market. So it's sort of the nexus of a bunch of strands of this story. And part of the story of the housing crisis that really hadn't been told yet or hadn't been told, I thought, in a useful way.
So the city is thriving, right? I mean, set the scene for us. What is Seattle looking like right now? We think we know it, but, you know, where does it stand?
It's booming. I mean, it's a tech-fueled boom and, you know, as you said in the intro there, bringing in lots of people. And that's bidding up the price of housing faster than the local market can deliver new supply. And that's really been the conventional narrative of the housing crisis, both in Seattle, but also in a lot of other urban areas, that you have this, you know, they're basically the housing crisis is the sort of the symptom of success. And it really causes people to sort of assume that this affordability crisis is really – that we're stuck with it. It's sort of permanent. It's a permanent aspect of success for urban environments. And one of the things I wanted to get at here was that there are other elements here that aren't really being surfaced yet, and those point to some of the deeper drivers but also to some of the policy solutions we should be looking at.
You know, I think from the outside, folks might say, gee, nice problem to have. But I'd like to hear a little bit how this plays out. We have a couple of clips of interviews that were done. Last year, Svenja Gödel, she's the chief economist for the real estate website Zillow, gave an interview to Jake Wittenberg, who's a reporter with King 5 TV in Seattle. She offers a hot take about the city's red-hot real estate market.
We'll see, you know, a few more years of very rapid growth. Again, brought on by a very healthy, well-functioning local economy over here. And so we're not going to see any sort of plateauing anytime soon.
Here in Seattle, Goodell's confident that the market won't slow down until there are more houses. It's a serious supply and demand issue right now.
That supply and demand issue plays out in a human way. We'll hear now from Rebecca Bradley. She's a teacher in San Francisco. She was speaking in February to NBC's Ron Allen and talked about fears that she might be priced out of her community.
I don't want to rent a studio because that would be more than half of my salary. I don't want to leave this community.
Do you feel like you might have to?
Oh, yeah.
The soaring cost of housing here, fueled largely by the tech boom, is cited as a major reason. The median monthly rent here is roughly 78% of a typical teacher's salary.
78%. So that's obviously San Francisco, not Seattle. But Seattle, it's not that it's not immune from it. Seattle's basically enmeshed in the same issue, right?
It's trying, yeah, it's catching up. I mean, if you look at the how long it takes for, say, the you know, a person to save up to buy a house, that's the sort of the hot indicator now. And San Francisco, you know, the Bay Area, we're looking at 27 to 30 years. So basically, you're not, just not going to buy a house. Seattle is not there yet, but it's still.
So where's, you know, where's it up there?
15 or 16 years. And if you look back right before the recession, it was probably 8 years. So what that's telling millennials is that you shouldn't even bother, or you're going to have to sort of rethink your idea of housing success, or you're going to have to get politically active. So all those narratives are playing out in cities like Seattle.
You talk a little bit in your piece about the question of zoning and the question of whether or not there should be higher density buildings built. I want to take a call. We've got a call along these lines from Park Falls, Wisconsin. Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, David. In this struggle over globalization, we've had some very big winners and very big losers. The big cities in America have been very, very big winners. They're all run by Democrat Party administrations. And to all of them, they have enacted these extremely restrictive zoning laws to protect basically the wealth that's invested in homes by very, very wealthy people. In San Francisco, for instance, the average house, I understand, costs over $1 million. And what this restrictive zoning does is it acts as a bar to keep people from immigrating to these cities from other parts of the United States that have been really, really hurt by globalization, because those people could take some of these jobs in high tech and really earn some very large incomes if they were allowed to move there. But they're not allowed to move there because they can't afford a house that costs $1 million.
Rick, thank you for that. It's a steep price indeed, just for the right to be able to live and work in a city like Seattle. Paul Roberts, you know, you talk in your story about proposals to allow more dense zoning, and that sounds like it's a kind of, well, you know, it's a logistical question, it's a technical question. But what we're really saying is that not everything being built should be allowed to be a single family home. Tell me how that plays out there in Seattle.
Well, I mean, Rick has it largely right. You know, you had a lot of home buyers, boomers, essentially, who were able to buy cheaply in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it was sort of a historical accident. You had a post-war building boom, construction boom that created a lot of supply, kept prices down, and then you had rising wages. And that allowed a lot of boomers to get into the housing market and begin moving up the housing ladder. And, you know, flash forward to today and millennials find a very different situation, flat wages and much higher housing prices. Now, you could leave it at that and just say it is simply a historical accident and we have the politics of envy here and millennials are just better, you know, sort of buck up, except that, as Rick alluded to, many of the boomers, after they had situated themselves in these housing markets, in these urban areas, then changed the zoning so that it made it harder to add new density in their neighborhoods, add housing supply. And that is one of the factors, certainly not the only one, but it's one of the factors contributing to the constraint in supply today.
Well, and the law has effects, right? I remember a friend of mine back when I was a congressional reporter was accosted by Charlie Rangel, then a very senior Democrat mm-hmm. in the House of Representatives. And he basically said, "Young man, have you bought yourself a house?" My friend,
right.
A very distinguished reporter, said no. He says, "We wrote the laws for you to buy a house. Go buy a house." It was essentially the law of the land, encouraging right. them with these write-offs and mortgages to get people to be homeowners. That was seen as the American ideal and kind of a guarantee, right, of what families could experience. And you're saying that's not the case for young families, for young professionals, even those. What's interesting, you hear teachers, and they should be paid a heck of a lot more than they are, you know, if you look at the role they play in raising our kids. But even people in tech industries that you think of are going to be well compensated from the get-go.
Right. So absolutely. So people like, say, Zach Lubarsky in the story, I mean, he's well paid, but he would struggle to get into some of the homes and some of the neighborhoods we were looking at in the article. Now, granted, you know, you get out of college, your first few years, you're not going to jump right into a nice single-family home. The idea is you get on the ladder and begin moving up. But the ladder is a lot taller today, and it's not all down to zoning. But you look at neighborhoods in places like Seattle, and in the 70s and 80s, developers came in and they wanted to build triplexes and duplexes in these single-family neighborhoods, which, by the way, account for more than half of the housing area in Seattle. And homeowners said, look, I don't want to have an apartment or a duplex next door. And they litigated and lobbied and got a huge downzone. That is, they changed the zoning. And today you have a sort of a different political philosophy in City Hall. You have a pro-density, let's build more housing, let's infill. For all these – you know, it's not just for affordability. It's more easy to serve transit. It's more environmentally sound. So there's all these sort of political reasons, but you have at the center of it a kind of a boomer-led political obstacle, and it's creating a huge amount of tension in markets like Seattle.
I think maybe we should take a call from Miami, Florida. Janet, you've got a bit of time. Tell me what your experience is down there.
Yeah, hi, David. Down here, I don't know how young people are going to be able to afford a home. We purchased our home over 15 years ago, and we were lucky because we cannot afford our neighborhood if we had to buy now. Uh-huh. Young people can't afford the rents down here, and they sure as hell can't afford the cost of living and of what real estate is costing down here. So they don't really have a chance.
Thank you so much, Janet. Paul, my sense is that you're in this millennial cohort yourself. Are you a homeowner there?
No and no. So I'm 56. And so when I got to Seattle in the late 70s, I was in that sort of hopeful cohort that just assumed, had the expectation that after a few years of saving, I'd get a house. So I'm watching it from the kind of the sort of cynical eye of someone who's seen the market change and doesn't want to tell millennials to go elsewhere, but I kind of feel uh-huh. that is the message they're getting.
And also the message, never judge a man's age by his voice. Paul Roberts, stick around with us. You've written about this for Politico. We're discussing housing issues in major cities around the nation. You can join this conversation. Is this an availability problem or an affordability problem or symptoms of a larger issue? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the affordable housing crisis in big cities across the country. You can join the conversation. Are these areas equipped to handle all these extra people? Do they have the roads, the transit, the schools to deal with this influx? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We've been talking to Paul Roberts. He's a journalist who's been writing about this for Politico. Joining us also now from Berkeley, California, is Carol Galante. She's a professor of affordable housing and urban policy at the University of California, Berkeley. She served as the Assistant Secretary for Housing and the Federal Housing Commissioner at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development from 2011 to 2014. Carol Galante, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David, for having me.
So I want to play read a little bit from a couple comments we've gotten. I thought they were instructive and interesting. This Kent Elliott is a title examiner. He posted on Facebook. He said, it's always a trip to read through old probates and see the death certificates. The people were high school graduates. The wife was a homemaker. They owned homes and acreage so easily. It was like all you had to do was grow up and then you could buy property. Similarly, another comment from Matt MC, my anecdotal experience has been that all the new construction goes toward luxury condos or apartments or low-income housing. Everyone, even remotely in the middle of the income scale, gets squeezed. And we have a call on line three from Charleston, South Carolina. John, I think you have a similar point to make. John, are you there, fella?
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
My comment is, in Charleston here, We're a high-growth area. You know, we're a boom town. Excuse me. We have seen our population double over the last 10 years. And rents in of itself have doubled as well in the last five. Home prices are back to 05, 06 levels. What this is doing is it's creating a boom for the developers. So we are building, and we are building high density. but it's all luxury apartments.
Uh-huh.
And it's all higher end, and the rents continue to grow. And what we have is a lot of folks that are moving in from much higher cost of living areas. So for those, it's you know, cheap for them. But for those of us that have been around here or from here, it's the wages haven't kept up. And on top of that, the urban sprawl that we're developing, the rents continue to grow up in those areas as well as home prices.
So,
and you couple that with a lack of infrastructure for public transportation, and you have no way for the average worker to be able to afford to live here unless you're double or tripling up, which is fine if you're 20-something that doesn't have any kids or, you know, has a student loan payment and a car payment. But other than that, it's getting increasingly difficult to live in those areas that everyone wants to live in.
John, thank you for the take from Charleston, South Carolina. Carol Galante, you were the Federal Housing Commissioner, and so you had a pretty big perch from which to look at all this. Is this a housing availability problem? Is this a housing affordability problem? Are these symptoms of something actually larger? How should we think about this?
Yes, thanks. Thanks for the question. I mean, this is a very complex problem that has its roots, frankly, generations ago, as Paul mentioned. And I think we need to keep that in perspective in looking for solutions. I mean, we had a federal government in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, housing that post-war generation. My parents, you know, could buy a home in a suburban community, and I will put a caveat on it. If you were white, you could buy a home in a suburban community with very little down, but through the support of the Federal Housing Administration. And the government, the federal government, you know, paid for all the roads and the water and sewer grants that went to localities to kind of extend the infrastructure to these new communities. And so that fueled this post-war boom of single-family homes and neighborhoods. And we stopped that kind of, you know, infrastructure investment, you know, generations ago. So the seeds of the problem, you know, go back to that. And I would just say to the caller from Charlotte, as just an example, we also have now a huge surge in rental rentership because of the foreclosure crisis and so many people who lost their homes. And so we have new renters there. We have a baby boomlet in the millennial generation, which is now the largest, you know, generation. And they're young people, and so they are going to rent for a few more years. Yes, they want to own a home, but you know, they're going to rent for a while. And then the last point I would want to make on this luxury development is to maybe make clear that part of the challenge with that is developers have to spend a lot of money to build these homes. And if they can't get a certain rent level, then they're not going to build it because the cost of construction and the cost of development, because of all the barriers that, you know, Paul mentioned, because of the lack of the labor force. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but the cost of new development is extraordinarily more expensive than it was, you know, even 10 years ago. And continuing to rise rapidly. And so that's really creates this problem of only the upper end and not housing for kind of the vast middle class that you're talking about. And so we need solutions, and happy to talk about some of those, but we need solutions to help lower the cost of new development so that you can lower the home price and rental amounts that could be charged for those homes.
And I'll want to talk about some of your digital tools a bit later on in the show. Paul Roberts, you wrote about Seattle and about things there. It is a city and a region that considers itself progressive, that cares about, you know, such issues as social justice and about the question of income unevenness and ways in which people's incomes aren't aligned. They've taken some active measures there. They've spent some money. They've sought some remedies. How well have these worked?
Well, you know, I mean, to go back to Carol's point about race, I mean, that's a really important framing to bring this to because, you know,
if you'd like to talk about race, we do have a call that I want to hear from as we think about this to help us frame that. Nikki is calling us from Detroit. You had something you wanted to add to this conversation. Go ahead.
Hi, David.
Hi, Nikki.
Yeah, so to contextualize this, I just finished reading Segrue's Origins of the Urban Crisis. And as a resident of Detroit, it made me think a lot. And I wanted to say that, you know, this housing, you know, multi-housing units were not allowed based on race. So, you know, multifamily units weren't allowed because certain cities, and I don't know what it is for Seattle, but certain cities didn't want certain people. So they said, okay, single family housing, because we know that only a certain type of person can purchase that, right? So I just found it really humorous that the problem that certain cities created for themselves to keep certain people out is now a problem that they're now facing. But now that, you know, a certain majority or, you know, white group is now facing this problem, now we're finding issues, or now we're finding ways to fix it, versus it's still a problem for, you know, in Detroit. I mean, we're booming, but there's still a lot of people that need affordable housing. And I just, no one's doing, or not, I wouldn't say nobody, but fewer people are doing things here. I just found it humorous that Seattle is like the hot city that we're talking about affordable housing in, because it seems from the way it was framed like a white problem. So now it's like, needs to be addressed, if that makes sense.
Nikki, thank you for framing that. Paul Roberts, you wanted to actually address points along that line and that very historical legacy. Go ahead.
Yeah, so she's exactly right. I mean, you know, this is something that communities of color have been dealing with since the beginning. And Seattle, despite its progressive, you know, reputation, has exactly that legacy of excluding communities of color from a lot of these neighborhoods. It is now the fact that you have a lot of white kids who are finding themselves on the end of the exclusion stick that it suddenly becomes a sort of a mainstream issue. And, you know, to be fair, housing activists and activists representing communities of color have been pushing that issue for a long time. But it is, you know, moving into the mainstream. As far as addressing it, you know, Seattle has been front and center in terms of taxing its residents and trying to build, government-supported, publicly-supported housing for low income. But, you know, the amount of money you need to move the market in that regard it's huge. They're spending like $290 million over the next decade, and they're going to get a couple hundred units of affordable housing each year. So it's important, but it's a drop in the bucket. And this is why there's this big push to let the market – to sort of unrestrain, liberate the market, the housing market, and let it do its work. And that creates a whole new political tension, because in progressive communities, there's a huge amount of skepticism about the free market. And that's really what these hot housing markets are now confronting. It's, do we trust that market, you know, that brought us to, among other things, the housing crisis a decade ago? And if we do trust it, are there ways that we need to sort of control it, guide it, tweak it? You know, it's kind of a new era in terms of those sorts of questions, and it's particularly unsettling for progressive communities who, again, have always been deeply skeptical of the market.
Carol Galantis, I want to ask you, you know, I live in Manhattan, obviously. That's a place which has real distortions, and while it has had booms of sorts, it's not quite in the same category as these newer tech hubs that have emerged. At the same time, I remember a very interesting and provocative column by the then New York Times libertarian columnist John Tierney, in which he said, you know, rent control is basically killing the middle class, because it's essentially stripping away incentives for people to build certain kinds of new units, and it's also stripping away incentives for people to do improvements, and it's just contributing to the Manhattanization effect, which is where you have the very rich and people often very modest means in the same city, and you're squeezing out really hard a lot of the middle class, even at times the upper middle class. What do you think of this idea that Paul Roberts has just raised about stripping away a lot of the regulations and letting the market determine what kinds of, you know, with standards of quality perhaps, but what kinds of housing is allowed in an area?
Well, let me just say that to Paul's point about the cost of building dedicated affordable housing for people at the lower income end of the spectrum. I mean, we need to keep doing that. Even there, I mean, in California, it would cost $250 billion to, you know, house all the people who earn, you know, less than, say, 50% of the income. And, you know, we're not going to find that kind of funding anytime soon. And in the meantime, you know, we also need to take the pressure off the existing stock, you know, homes and apartments that higher income people are essentially bidding getting the lower income folks out for and still struggling themselves, right? So to me, we have to have an efficient market that is building more for the vast middle class, you know, if for no other reason than to take the pressure off of that existing housing stock. And having said that, I think there are lots of challenges to that, but there are some solutions that we all should be focused on, including, you know, knitting in to these single family communities, smaller homes, accessory dwelling units. We've done a lot in that regard in California, and there's still more to do. But, you know, to the point of, you know, adding, quote, density in some of these single family neighborhoods, you're actually just bringing the population back to the population that was there in the 1950s and 60s, because people living in these single family homes today, you know, are one or two person households traditionally. And, you know, those homes were built to accommodate a higher population than that. So, you know, there is a way to, you know, provide evidence to folks that doing some of that, you know, is not going to have a negative impact on their communities.
Wanted to take a call from Asheville, North Carolina. Kim's calling in. You're a real estate agent. Tell us your observations.
Hi, David. I am a real estate agent, and we have two problems here. The first is that we're basically a tourist area, and we have low-paying tourist jobs. Mm-hmm. And the second is we're a big retirement area, so people are moving in from out of state who have sold expensive houses, and they come and they think the housing prices here are low, but the people who work here can't afford them. I worked with a high school teacher recently, single mom with two sons, and we looked for 6 months and could not find her anything to buy.
Thanks so much for that. Thanks you so much for that, Kim. I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is Elizabeth Greenspan. She's a writer and urban anthropologist who regularly writes about big cities, their architecture, their design. She writes for The New Yorker. She writes for Architect Magazine. She's also a lecturer in the University of Pennsylvania's Urban Studies Program and a senior researcher in the School of Design. I have no idea how you have time to join us, but Liz Greenspan, thank you for coming on Point today.
Hi, David. Thanks.
So you've written, among other things, among many other things, about the aesthetic and culture of cities and urban planning. And you talk about, in some ways, the luxury aesthetic that accretes to places like Seattle and major sort of urban boom centers. What are people looking for as they're drawn to cities like this?
Well, one of the things that happens is, you know, as you have more expensive housing, you have, you know, people who have a lot of money and can afford to buy more expensive things and take advantage of more expensive services. And so the entire city starts to orient itself towards serving that kind of clientele, groceries, you know, high-end stores. And so and part of this then comes along with a certain look and feel that I think a lot of us probably recognize, where you see shopping districts in Manhattan and San Francisco and Seattle, and they all kind of look the same. We see the same stores. And so, you know, and it's, and everyone kind of knows that this is for people who have a lot of money to spend. And one of the things that does is sends a signal to everyone else who doesn't have a lot of money that, you know, this isn't really a space for them, maybe, that, you know, they don't belong here. And then that gets, you know, just to tap into what we've been talking about already in terms of class, questions of class and race. You know, wealth is deeply tied to racial stratification in this country. So you start to have in very expensive cities, you start to have a more homogenous population.
So,
you know, you don't.
Go ahead.
And you don't get the kind of, you know, you don't get the kind of mixing of different people in different backgrounds that is one of the things that makes cities, you know, such exciting places to be.
So this is something that affects cities large and small. Back in 2015, the mayor of Princeton, New Jersey, Liz Lempert, was talking to public television network NJTV, and she said housing was a premium in her affluent city as well.
Our waiting list right now for affordable housing are over 1,000 families long. Because we're a desirable town, we do see our property tax rates going up or our property values going up. And we understand it's, you know, affordability is a huge issue.
Paul Roberts, briefly in the 30 seconds we have left before this break, you know, what are the things that people are looking for lifestyle-wise, the signifiers that people are drawn to Seattle for?
Well, it's exactly what Elizabeth is pointing out. They're looking for the cultural amenities that sort of signal hot urban market. So they want, you know, they want nightlife, they want parks, they want environmental amenities, they want good transit. And, you know, cities are advertising themselves as having those things, but it's often hard to deliver them once the people show up.
Guys, I'd like you all to stick around. We're discussing the affordable housing crisis in some of the country's biggest housing markets. You can join the conversation. Are cities still the vibrant urban centers of American life they once were? If they're not, can that return? If it has returned with a vengeance, is it too hot to stick around? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the lack of affordable housing in big cities around the nation. You can join the conversation. What do you want from your home, your city? How do you make cities more appealing? What trade-offs are you willing to make? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Paul Roberts, who's been writing about just this subject for Politico. Liz Greenspan, a writer, urban anthropologist, and lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania's Urban Studies Program. And Carol Galante, a professor at UC Berkeley, who's also a former top housing official during the Obama administration. You know, I saw in Paul, in your piece, I think it was, that you mentioned a number of cities in which people were being offered money to return to other places. I think there was Hamilton, Ohio, Webster, Indiana, North Platte, Nebraska, cities that were saying, hey, we'd like you to come visit us. We've got affordable housing. We've got places where jobs are looking for people to take them. Why don't you come to us? Is this a free market way, a possible solution from what you've heard?
Well, I mean, you do see rural areas that are struggling economically, looking for ways to attract exactly that kind of knowledge worker that's showing up instead in Seattle. If they can afford it, so far I've seen that the returns on those kinds of investments aren't really encouraging. And but one of your callers pointed out earlier that you've got this huge disparity, not just within cities, but geographically, where there are whole areas of the city that could definitely use a shot or an influx of this talent, these workers, these knowledge workers with their skills, and yet they don't have the other amenities to offer them. So, I think as Carol pointed out, we just don't have the public dollars to make those sorts of subsidies work, and it's really going to have a market component, and that of course goes right to that sort of political tension about how much do progressive policymakers trust or are willing to trust the marketplace.
There's a comment from our website, JPX234 writes, we have plenty of locations typical folk don't want to live in, the Fall Rivers, the Lowells, the Worcesters, the Springfields. I'm guessing JPX234 is from Massachusetts. The poster writes, I think folks need to be a bit more creative with where they look, and this includes where business locates. The wealth needs to be spread out across the states. It's much healthier than building super high densities in the big cities while leaving other smaller cities to rot. Liz Greenspan, you've written about the history of cities and planning a lot. I remember growing up in the 70s, the big cities were basically being written off. They were impossible to manage, impossible to live in. You know, you think of when Law and Order came on TV in the late 80s, early 90s, and it was always just, my God, there was either a murder a moment. And that's not life as it's always lived. What role has the growth and the vibrance of a number of American big cities played to the economy? Has this been in some ways a valuable thing as well as clearly a corrosive one in terms of affordability?
Yeah. I mean, you know, about 30 to 40 years ago, most cities were really, really struggling. You know, there was steep decline from this post-World War II era when everyone left for the suburbs. And I think, you know, no one would have imagined that you would be seeing cities today where you have these really thriving, vibrant, and expensive downtowns. And so, you know, people are rediscovering now the virtues and value of living in walkable neighborhoods and, you know, walking to their grocery store and being able to walk to the park and not having to drive so much. You know, there's a lot of great stuff, which is why people want to move here, especially young people, to so many cities. But there is this, you know, supply and demand problem just at a basic level. And it does mean that I think certain ideals, you know, a certain suburban ideal of a single family home is probably going to have to change. I mean, that's just not tenable when you're talking about living in a downtown area. And, you know, and I'm not so sure that everyone even wants that. I mean, everyone wants a home. But the idea that the single-family home is this ideal that we're all supposed to aspire to is something that I think a lot of people already feel is kind of out of date. And so one of the questions then are, what are the new kinds of housing? And it's a design question in part, too. You know, what are the new kinds of housing that we can build in cities that can accommodate this real mix of people, multi-generations, people, just couples, people with kids, you know, kind of the whole mix to bring them all together, since they're here now and there seems to be this big demand.
Carol Galante, as a housing commissioner, as a housing official, you obviously, as we say, have really had to think about this sort of in pointless detail and also in the big picture. Not so long ago, I guess a couple of years back, you introduced it at Berkeley, a digital dashboard with a couple of tools. I mean, we're in the age of big data, and this seems to have been a boom driven by the growth of data and computer and digital mastery. So why not use some of these fascinating tools to try to resolve it? You came up with your own, in which you said, look, we're going to focus on a couple of factors and see if we can get them to interplay and come up with some solutions. What were you trying to do there?
Yeah, thanks for raising that. What we were trying to do there and what we're still doing with that tool is to demonstrate to local municipalities what it takes. What's the probability that you can get a particular development actually economically feasible with the policies that you have in place? And so there's an interactive component between how much parking you require, how much affordability you require within a market rate development, what fees that you charge that development, versus what rents you want that development to be able to sustain. And you can, look at how many more housing units you could have in your community if you were willing to work on some of the policy implications of density, parking, speed of processing through your local government approval process, for example. And so it's a very valuable tool in terms of helping cities conceptualize the trade-offs and the implications of various decisions.
You also had a second element, if I recall correctly, that focused on a number of major centers in the Bay Area itself, and you're not so far from Berkeley. What did you learn from that kind of detailed analysis?
We learned a couple of things. First of all, is that they're each different, and so what dials you turn, it makes a difference where you're starting from. So San Francisco already has a very low parking requirement, and so that dial changing that doesn't make that much difference. But Oakland had a fairly high parking requirement, so that makes a big difference. And the most important thing I would say that we learned is if you're a community, a small community that's mostly single-family zoned, you know, none of these dials really make a difference. You've got to, you know, find ways in your downtown commercial core, in your vacant properties, to actually find ways to create more density around your transit hubs. Otherwise, you're simply, not going to be able to make a dent in the number of housing units and the affordability of those homes.
We want to take a couple of quick calls. First, we'll go to Josh. He's calling from Grand Haven, Michigan. Josh, go ahead.
Hi, David. I'm on the city council in Grand Haven, and we are a population of about 10,000. We've been recently featured on Good Morning America's Best Beachside Towns in America, and the same with Coastal Living.
Congratulations.
What has happened in our predominantly single-family residential area is housing prices have gone up. Sure. We're supported financially by a little bit of manufacturing as well as retail and supporting industries for the commercial, for the tourists that come in. The challenge we're facing is, in particular from our employers, is finding qualified workers who they can afford to pay. And the biggest complaint from the qualified workers is the wages are not high enough for them to live in the city of Grand Haven anymore.
Uh-huh.
So my question is, at what point do wages become a defining factor in housing affordability in a small-town community or a large metropolitan one like you're discussing today?
And I'd like to pair this with a call from Madison, Wisconsin. Joseph, briefly, you're saying it's not just the West Coast. What's your experience?
Hi, David. I just wanted to note that the issues of cost of rent are not limited to coastal cities with strict zoning.
Uh-huh.
I am a former resident of Las Vegas, Nevada, in the process of returning so I can get an entry-level job and a new career, and the cost of rent has gone nuts in the 2 years since I left.
Uh-huh.
A decent apartment that would avoid my prior issues with toxic mold would be more than half my salary, and this is not an expensive city.
Uh-huh.
I've had so many issues finding affordable housing that I'm considering investing all my savings in converting a retired school bus into an RV.
A retired school bus.
RV park.
Wow. Joseph, thank you for that. I wish you best of luck when you return back to Nevada. Liz Greenspan, you know, what does pressure on wages do to a city? How does it affect who decides to come into town, and how does it affect what the setting is like for housing and the rest of the city around them?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of us are wondering that question. I mean, right now, the people who can afford to live to afford expensive rents or to buy are often the ones making, you know, the high salaries that the tech and, you know, finance sectors tend to provide, and everyone else is really struggling. So some people do think that eventually employers will have to pay more in order to accommodate their workers or to, you know, make it so that they don't have to commute so far. I mean, that's one of the other things you see happening in a lot of cities is people have to live really far from their jobs in order to afford a place to live. But I also think that one of the other pieces of this is a design question and a construction question. It's something Carol was talking about how expensive it is to build. And, you know, that's true, but it's something that a lot of firms and architects are also working on, and they're coming up with some really innovative models on how to make, you know, not cheap housing, but, you know, really good, durable housing that's well-designed, but that's cheaper to build.
What do you mean by that, Liz?
Well, so, you know, I think, I mean, one of the things that has happened is that there's this sense that good design means luxury design. And I think that that's a really dangerous and unfortunate mm-hmm. coupling, because it doesn't have to mean that. And so one of the things that more designers are looking at now is how to take new materials, how to speed up the production process, you know, with mass production, to create, you know, reasonably sized apartments, right? Like something that's like 12 to 1400 square feet instead of, say, 3000 square feet, which is the size of homes we lived in, you know, 50 years ago, say. And to build just really good, solid, well-designed units in cities that can have a lower price point because they were produced, you know, the construction process was cheaper too. This isn't happening at the scale it really needs to, I think. But you know, there are companies and firms, you know, here in Philly, and some of cities that don't quite have the pressures, you know, ironically, they have same housing pressures, they're able to be a little more experimental.
Uh-huh.
But they're coming up with some cool things. And I think that's something we're going to see more of.
Carol Galante, in the Bay Area, where prices are sky high, legendarily sky high, and the stock is fairly scarce, what appetite is there for saying, you know what, we're going to encourage people to make smaller homes. We're going to encourage them to make things a little bit more durable. And, you know, we'll get less tax revenue for each of these homes, but we'll get people in. It'll be a good thing.
There's some appetite at the local level, and there's some experimentation with, you know, developing you know, very small, almost bedrooms and, you know, more common area space. So you've got, you know, a 5-bedroom apartment with, you know, single individuals living in each of their own exclusive bedrooms, but with, you know, great common areas, which is much more affordable, you know, per person than the typical apartment complex, for example. So there's some willingness to do that. But I guess I would say that this challenge of knitting in more people into the existing communities at the local level is going to continue to be a challenge unless, in my view, we get above that a little bit and think about this more as a regional problem or a statewide problem that has carrots and sticks coming from, you know, outside the local community to, you know, get communities to accommodate this diverse population, and again, including the dealing with the people who are being so pressured by the lack of affordability, but also accommodating our new high-tech workforce, because that's what's driving the economy in the Bay Area. And, you know, it's important that, you know, we be able to accommodate both of those groups of folks. And I think jurisdiction, municipality by municipality, at least in a place like the Bay Area. Uh-huh. We have 100 different cities and 26 different transit organizations servicing that region. And we've got to have a regional or statewide kind of policy context to help get this right. It's not going to happen jurisdiction by jurisdiction, in my view.
Gosh, you know, it's hard enough to get the buses to separate on my street in New York. This coordinating all this sounds pretty complicated. Paul Roberts, hop on in.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, both, you know, Carol Elizabeth make good points about the need for better design and better regional coordination. But what's really sort of interesting to watch is that as these regions and cities are trying to come up with better design and better coordination to come up with more affordability or more affordable housing, you know, other elements in those same municipalities are trying to attract tech business because that's seen as the key to a successful future. So look at the hunt for Amazon's second headquarters. You know, that created this uh-huh. frenzy of bidding by these cities and states. And yet when you look at – when they do surveys, they did a survey a couple of weeks ago about asking residents, do you even want Amazon's second headquarters in your city? And, you know, the biggest popularity was in Atlanta, where just over half of the residents saw it as a – would see it as a bonus. And in a city like Boston, it's like one-third – you know, two-thirds of the residents don't want it there. So there's this recognition that cities have to be very careful about what they wish for. You know, it's all fine to put in place these policies to work to develop and encourage more affordable housing. But if at the same time you're looking to import 10 or 20 or 50,000 high-paid workers, you are guaranteeing that your housing market is not going to be able to keep up with demand. And that is – it points to another political tension that we really haven't resolved.
Liz Greenspan, we only have about 30, 40 seconds left. But, you know, this is a problem, as one of our callers mentioned earlier, that sounds like it's focusing on people who are relatively privileged. How is this really affecting those at the very lower ends of the tier financially on this?
Well, there are people in a lot of these cities who are working jobs in the cities, but they really can't afford to live there. There are low-income workers. There are homeless populations. And so it's easy, very easy to forget them when we're talking about all of this. There are also people who are living outside the cities. And so it's a whole other conversation. But we need all of these issues, affordable housing in particular, to be at the fore as we think about where people are going to live.
That's Liz Greenspan. She's writer and lecturer in the University of Pennsylvania's Urban Studies Program. Liz, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
We've also been hearing from Carol Galante from the University of California at Berkeley and a former federal housing commissioner. Carol, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Paul Roberts kicked us off with his article from Politico. Thanks so much for joining us today, Paul.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.